Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Tech entrepreneur and journalist Mark Little, welcome.
Hiya, Brendan.
And Mark, I feel like saying an anthropologist, because I feel you're becoming now an anthropologist of this very fast-changing world we live in. And I'm looking forward to this now, because today we're going to get down with the kids. You've been thinking a lot about your children's generation, Gen Z. And I think you're challenging maybe some of the kind of easy assumptions we make about them. I think this has been informed by talking to your own children a bit as well about when we were Gen Z and your fears when you were their age.
Yeah, what I've noticed is that they're kind of the main character, but they're sort of on the sidelines of many of the storylines we've talked about here, about the impact of technology, you know, the American election, young people voting for Trump. Why do they do that? What's the culture here? And of course, we have Jonathan Haidt, who was on your show, I know, last year, I think it was, talking about this being the anxious generation. So whenever my kids hear themselves reflected on television or radio, it's about their mental health crisis. It's about their being trapped in their phones. It's about the fact that they are disconnected from society. And they're like, well, actually, I don't see myself in the way I'm presented here. Okay. So when I talk to my kids who are 18, 21, I was on holiday 2 weeks with six Gen Zs, and we had an incredible time. But they totally contradicted my view that my responsibility as a parent right now is to panic. And they're like, no, we're taking care of ourselves. So for them, in many ways, technology is not the prison that we think it is for them, making them anxious constantly. It's actually a sanctuary. It's a place where they feel they've got some control. They're not supervised by parents. They're online. They're talking to each other. But it's also a sanctuary from the real life that excludes them and cuts them off. So they're the first generation to be dealing with climate crisis. They're a generation that have dealt with COVID in a very real and visceral way. These are people who don't, you know, expect to buy houses until they're in their 50s. And on top of that, they have artificial intelligence coming down the line, making them feel like it's not a question of, will I get a job? It's, will I have a career? Now, all of that, they are dealing remarkably well. They are an incredibly resilient generation.
Okay,
so for me, it's a glimpse of a future that might be a bit more optimistic.
Okay, that's good, because our attitude seems to be is that we obsess about how do we protect them from the world that we created. Like, you're saying, well, why do we listen to them first? Yeah.
And Jonathan Haidt makes this point. He said, if you think about the supervision of a child right now, any free experience in their day to wander off and play with their mates without supervision, that's disappeared over the past 10, 15 years. And for many young people, going online is that sanctuary. It's also, for example, for those people who are thinking about the big crisis in their life, they do feel in some ways when they're online, they have a bigger sense of agency over their lives. They get excluded from society, but when they're together with their friends online, there's a lot more agency there. So I think there is something about the online world for them. Now, they do say have a certain resentment of that dependence.
Do they?
So they report, for example, that they do resent and regret the invention of social media. Many of them do, in a majority in some surveys. And they feel they're in this trap. There was a remarkable study done last year that said Gen Z would pay money if they could leave social media to each other. But at the same time...
No, they would have to be paid money to give up their social media, wasn't it? But they would pay money for everyone to give up
exactly
social media.
So they can't leave because their friends are on it.
Yeah.
But they wish and would pay money to get off if their friends would come with them as well.
Yeah.
So there's this great phrase I keep hearing from talking to my, you know, kids' friends, touching grass.
Okay.
This idea. And it's a phrase that was used in online gaming years ago, which was, you know, calm down. The game's not that important. And a lot of young people talk about this concept of touching grass, that you don't live exclusively in the online world, that you actually physically connect yourself back to the physical world. So this year, you're seeing a surge in interest in people digital detoxes, which could be anything from turning on your phone notification or off your phone notifications or taking a break from that media. But it's also being expressed in people moving away from social media, the big platforms like TikTok, to much smaller niche online communities that are safer and that are organized around people's interests, whether it be baking or a specific musician. So people are moving to a platform that parents might recognize called Discord, that used to be a conversational platform for gamers. It's now hosting more than 200 million people a month. Most are Gen Z, who are forming little safe communities like group chats to talk to each other about things that are very important to their lives, and then carrying that into the real world, into physical activities. So that's what they're talking about when they say we actually have a bigger resilience because we're now moving away from that exploitative social media. So I think there might be a shift here.
Okay. Are they better at the internet than us?
Much better. I keep thinking about them like dancing with the algorithms. You know, they know when they're online that whatever they feed into the machine is going to come back at them. So what we see a lot, and Jonathan Haidt talks about this, is that there's a kind of a shift from what we talked about, the age of attention, when we all feel like we're being commanded by the spectacle of a Donald Trump. There's a lot more of the age of intention. They're seeking out experiences online in the real world that speak to their best intentions, not hijack their worst instincts. And the big powerful trend here is nostalgia. They're like homesick for a world they don't remember because they didn't live in it before they were plugged in to the online world. And I think for me, that came up recently. My kids said, my daughter said to me, I went to a birthday party, 21st. No one took a photograph with a camera phone. It was all taken with Polaroid cameras and digital cameras because we want to print it out when we get home and have a physical reminder of what it was like to be in the room together. So going back to vinyl records, it was 400,000 vinyl records bought every year in Ireland.
Yeah.
So that sense of a physical,
and even in a weird way, even though we thought CDs was a degradation of the whole experience of owning and listening to music, and Emmett Kerwin, the playwright, was saying yesterday he's gone back to CDs. A lot of the kids are going back to CDs as well, aren't they?
And they're going back to physical activities.
I mean,
this is a particularly, what I think from my generation's point of view, and it's like a straight-laced generation, you know, drinking less, having less sex, doing less drugs. But in many cases, what they're doing is just switching their physical activities from activities like drinking in a pub to socializing together, going to libraries. But I mean, I always think that for me, one of the symbols of this is, you know, looking at the saunas on every beach in Ireland right now, there's a sense of people coming together in much more mindful physical surroundings, including cultural festivals. I mean, last week with Electric Picnic, a record attendance, it's a sense of being together again in real life. Now, again, they toggle between online and real.
Yeah.
Because their activities online then, they get to live them in real life with their friends in physical settings that are not
okay,
pubs.
So they've come up with a hybrid model. Okay, so that's all very nice. So what about some of the things we think we know about Gen Z? Like that, for example, they have become more right-wing and more conservative.
So we definitely know that in European elections, in the United States elections, certainly in 24, they have been shifting to vote for candidates of the right. So give you an example, in, you know, the United States in 2024, more people under 30 voted for Republican than any time since 2028. If you look in Europe, for example, many of these far-right parties are being driven to a large extent by young men who kind of attracted to this kind of rebellion, this aesthetic of transgressive aesthetic of the far right. But at the same time, you see the statistics which show that in the same election in 2024 in the US, less people identified as conservative than at any time since 2008, which shows you that what you're seeing here
and
is
their conservatism is actually the kind of anti-establishment that made us all lefties when we were kids. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So they're rebelling against an old order that literally has failed them. So I think almost verging on a sense of nihilism and the power of institutions to deliver for them. So it's an anti-establishment radical feeling that puts them in play for populist parties on the left as well as the right. I just think we're seeing the right-wing expression of that now.
Okay. Are they very cross with us then for the world we've left them with, yeah?
Well, think about it. I mean, think about at the moment what it takes to get to become a homeowner in this country, but also thinking about all the problems that are coming down the track. But what's quite interesting is while they are angry about the established order, they have an increasing faith in their own ability as a generation to fix things. So it's not that sort of raging anti-establishment that is in itself just purely destructive. They're thinking about ways in which they themselves can take on the establishment, but also be resilient and rebellious against the world that they've been given. But it does come with a lot of negativity. So, for example, the reason why in the United States right now there's such a surge in interest in cryptocurrencies is for young people, they can now buy an asset. It's not like a home, that they can drive the emotional contagion of that asset. They can see it increasing under their own steam. So it resembles the kind of games of social media they played. So they are expressing their need for power in very negative ways. But at the same time, I think through their resilience in finding ways to use social media for good and toggle between the real and the digital world, I think they're offering us a glimpse of a future in which people live lives that are much more intentional. So I think they're
escaping. What about the age of anxiety that we're told about, though? Are they very anxious and unhappy?
They are. And in Ireland, for example, we see 2/3 of Irish young people report that mental health is the biggest challenge. We clearly see isolation, dislocation reported in every social index. We see surveys that show us that while Irish young people, particularly teenagers, perform really well on education level, their mental health is way down the League of Nations. So that exists. But again, it's what's to blame for this and how do we solve it? And I think that's where young people have slightly different answers than just talking about online safety. I think they want more than that, and they certainly are committing now to much more resilient behaviours that I think we should listen to them more. And again, they do say, listen, you put us here, you know? You supervised us and made the online world a sanctuary for us, and also you took away the hope we have of living in an age where we have control. Remember, this generation are different from every generation in human history. They will live through a period of acceleration of history that no other group of humans have ever lived through.
And really, so, it is unique, isn't it?
It is unique. I mean, think about the speed and the scale of the approach of AI. In the workplace, we're already seeing surveys that show entry-level jobs that, you know, for careers.
And this is popular. Graduates, like?
This is graduates who might go into, you know, coding or law. And these are areas and workplaces now that we're showing the first signs that entry-level jobs are being replaced by AI. So again, they're facing into a period of change that's like no other for any generation. Potentially the only one that will suffer will be the one coming after them. So the scale of change here is enormous. And
equally,
that's why we need to be paying attention to that as much as their safety.
Listening to you, at the same time, you kind of think, okay, we were dealing with a different set of circumstances. But these kids are just like us too, in that they're telling their parents, look, the world has changed, and you know we're going to have a new kind of world, and we can deal with it and everything. I have a friend who's a marketing consultant, right? And when he goes into places, he doesn't allow them to talk about Gen Z, Gen Y, Gen X, any of that. He says, no, talk about people in their teenage years, talk about people in their 20s, talk about people in their 30s. And when you do that, you'll see that there's not actually that huge a difference between people in their teens before, people in their 20s before. There is a pattern there.
But
we wanted to be allowed to make our new world, didn't we?
We did, but I don't think we have the power that these guys have. And I would talk specifically about
it. So they're more
empowered,
actually, than we were to make a new world.
Absolutely. And I think the generation cutoff point that I would use, rather than the simple lazy, as you say, Gen Z and millennials, etc., is probably those people who are like 18 years old. Like my son was born the year the iPhone was unveiled.
Okay.
It's the people who are digital natives, right? These are people that don't have a memory of analog. For them, like us, technology is tools, right? Devices. For them, it's their habitat, their environment, the air they breathe, the water they swim in. They don't think or conscious about it. So that's the cutoff point. At what point did you forget what it was like to have a mixtape or, you know, all of the analog things we did? That is a very important cutoff.
Of course it is. Yeah. On a specific kind of moral panic that's going on at the moment, are they turning to chatbots for help? Yeah,
they are. I mean, Ireland is slightly behind the United States, where they say 3 out of 4 teenagers are now using chatbots as companions of some form. And 1 in 8 of a recent survey say they're turning to AI for therapy. So if there is one big looming challenge, I think, to the happy picture I painted for the Gen Z people, it is AI. Because obviously, first of all, it creates massive safety concerns. What happens when a kid is using an AI to try and solve their mental health problems? Now, we see extremely difficult cases where a young man...
Yeah, tell me about... there's this Californian couple, Matt and Maria Rain. They're suing OpenAI over the death of their 16-year-old son, Adam Rain.
And their son was discussing with the chatbot potential ideation of taking his own life. Nobody knew, but the AI knew and was playing along, essentially. And now ChatGPT have responded.
Encouraged him not to talk to his parents about it. Seems to have mentioned suicide, I think, 6 times more than he actually mentioned it.
Yes, so therefore what he's doing is that the AI is simply just taking something it's hearing and amplifying and doing it in a way.
Its kind of drive is to affirm people.
It is. It's, for example, like, you know, the algorithms on Spotify take your musical tastes and chase them down and, you know, serve you more and more of that. So this AI is listening to your tone of voice. Remember, this is a machine that's simply just predicting your next word. And therefore, in this case, the child was on its own, in the teenager in this case, and was essentially talking to a bot that was driving it down this pathway. Now, ChatGPT have come back, OpenAI, and say they've instituted new rules and regulations that will make sure that that kind of situation will be alerted to a parent. There'll be no way a parent wouldn't know about that stress. But at the same time, part of the bigger problem here is this generation of young people have found a voice in their head that is much more sympathetic than anything around it. And I think that, for me, threatens us with what educators already warn about, is a loss of critical thinking among young people who now don't have to turn in that essay that required 3 days' work. So what is lost when you lose that capacity for critical thinking that you get being in a classroom? Suddenly it's replaced by one voice in your head that's an AI that's flattering the best version of yourself.
Are the AI thing. Companies responding to the issues? Like, you know, the way we were talking there in the last hour about how difficult it is in terms of abuse and stuff to get the social media companies to take stuff down, to act. Are the AI companies acting a bit more fluidly about stuff?
They're acting probably faster than the social media companies did, you know, back in, let's say, 2015 or 16, when we started to see the results of, like, online hate or disinformation. But again, they're not acting as quick as the technology is developing. That's the problem. I think there's three broad concerns right now. One is the safety concern we've just talked about. The second is the kind of erosion of critical thinking. And I remember our last session with poet Rita Ann Higgins, where we couldn't spot the AI-generated version of her poem. So eroding our ability to see the difference between human and the machine. The third bigger danger for me, and this is where we have to go further than just resisting the digital onslaught, is that we have our futures in the hands of a couple of hundred, maybe a couple of thousand people, engineers in Silicon Valley, that are rewiring the human brain without any understanding of oversight, of what that might happen. So there's a sense of the corporate power of technology right now is probably the biggest danger, not just the safety issues right now, because those safety issues, it does seem that the companies are addressing a bit quicker than they did with social media.
But they're actually rewiring the collective unconscious of the world, in a sense.
They are. And therefore, what's the positive side of this is it's different to social media, where we kind of almost were unconscious being guided by the algorithm. Now there will be a conscious relationship one-to-one with this new intelligence that is should be a reflective of just our bigger brains. So there is a positive scenario if we have the right incentives. And that's to give us the ability to be conscious every time we're working with an AI chatbot, that we know there's a bit of hard work to be done. We're having critical thinking. So treating this technology a bit like a GPS. We know where we want to get to. It's setting a route for us. But we're in control all the way through to the outcome. And I think that's why, going back to Gen Z, they're much more, I think, acutely aware of that need to be always the human in the loop of the technology. So what I see that excites me is the way that they've started tweaking the algorithms to create new musical trends on Spotify. You know, for example, we have a huge increase in really roots music in the United States or in European countries that were dominated by English language music. Now it's local language. We have bands like Lancome, the rise of Kneecap. I mean, we've now seen that technology with a very conscious generation, intentional generation, starts to enrich culture as well. And I think that's one of the reasons why.
So a kind of a shattering of the monoculture, in a sense.
Yeah, we grew up, you know, you and me probably knowing that we couldn't avoid whatever the hit was. But now you see, for example, the enrichment of the Irish language. You go on TikTok and you ask for Ais Gaeilge, you'll get, I think last count, 120 million mentions. Because online, you can actually accelerate a niche community talking about something in a very authentic way. And again, to the nostalgia, I asked my daughter, well, why is this so attractive to you? This language to me was a little bit of a burden growing up.
Yeah.
She said, no, it's a really good way for me to connect with my nation. without the baggage that you probably had. So technology playing a role in enriching the lives of a generation that's much more intentional. That is the positive scenario with the rise of AI, I think.
Okay, yeah. You've been writing a bit about this in your business post, Colin. I like the touching grass thing. You talk as well about, you've a phrase of the acoustic internet.
Yeah, I was really noticing this after a pandemic when you started to see music on Spotify that became very powerful. I mentioned this very stripped down version of country music called roots music. You take out the electric guitar, you stay away from, collaborations with rap musicians, you go right back to basics. And we started to see this, and you see it again, I think, a lot in the appeal of traditional Irish music, which is strip away all of the things that were performative about the culture and let it be really authentic for me. So that nostalgia, authenticity, is creating a much more lo-fi experience of the internet. Small, safe communities, not big platforms. So for me, it's kind of like stripping away the extraneous bits and pieces in the recording.
Yeah,
a live version.
You've that word authentic. I think it's everywhere now at the moment. But like you, I remember you talking about it in terms of the presidential election candidates in America, that we had Kamala Harris could get up and make a really good prepared speech, but Trump was able to sit down and spitball with some idiot podcaster for 3 hours. It was authentic. Is authenticity central to what they want? Yeah,
it is, and it comes from rejection of the kind of performative nature of the influencer culture that dominated the first wave of social media. So people who are good at being online at the time were very popular. So politicians that are good at being politicians, that are safe, that look good when they stand up on a podium. Now the opposite's the case. This generation are basically rejecting the performative nature of culture. They're trying to basically be with the most authentic parts to it. So again, this idea of nostalgia before things were plugged in and turned up to 11, I think it's part of it.
Okay.
But also a certain authenticity and lack of historical baggage for them to be able to, like, you know, my daughter met DJ Brovia Mowgli Ba from Kneecap on the plane going to Amsterdam recently, and I was amazed to see every person, young person, gather around them and say thank you for expressing something about our culture. It was just quite amazing to see how they have got rid of the historical baggage.
Yeah.
And they now have a sense that these people are authentically representing them to the world. So there's something in that, I think, that points and glimpse of a future.
So listen, never mind what, you know, we're all obsessed with, like, we know everything and we'll teach it to the younger generations. What can us old Gen Xers learn from Gen Y?
I think it's a lesson in life that we learn when we get older, right? Which is, being anxious is not a bad thing. Being anxious is an invitation to think mindfully about your life, to sit down and touch grass and be with people in your life. And when we're facing into this technology revolution that makes us feel a lack of power, this is the first group of people. And again, I'm not going to make lazy generalizations, but that cutoff point of the natives, the kids are not only all right, they're fighting back, being more resilient, finding ways to overcome their anxiety. But they're also pointing us, as I say, I think, first of all, to an age of intentional use of the internet. And number two, they also know that resistance alone, like just by changing their habits, is not enough. There will have to be a rebellion against the centralization of power in the hands of these big companies that are not accountable. So, you know, I think they have given us a glimpse not only of what we will look like and what we will feel like to be in the future, but also have said there will be no change unless we do sit down and say, how do we challenge?
So hang on. Are you saying, when you say that they have shown us a way that this centralization of power can't continue, because it is only becoming more and more intensely centralized all the time, is this a moment in time where there are that small group of people, some of them, let's just call them, like, you know, nutters, really, for want of a better word, who are basically running the most powerful instruments in the world now? Is this a moment in time? Is there going to be a bottom-up movement where people are going to be able to reclaim back technology and how they use it?
There's a theory in history which says that when societies fall apart, people have two choices. One is voice, they protest, they fight. The other is exit, they just leave. This generation have looked at X and all the things that are going on there. They've seen the funhouse mirror of social media reflecting the very worst of society, and they've said, goodbye. We're leaving. We're going other places. They're creating a movement. Now, they haven't left social media completely, but what they're doing is going into communities and organizing themselves. Whereas I think a lot of us were sort of raging against the tide. So by showing us a change in our behavior, not to take seriously the tiny minority of people that dominate discourse on a platform like X and the radicalization of people who are on that platform, you can walk away and have a different relationship to technology.
Okay, but practical terms then for older people. How can we kind of try and abandon some of the negative bits of the world that we found ourselves caught up in and focus more on back to those kind of authentic, organic kind of things?
Well, first of all, look at your device in your hand and think about the times in your day when that steals away some moment that's important to you. So we have a digital detox movement now where getting up in the morning and not touching your phone until you've spoken to your family or had some physical activity, a little thing like that, the evidence suggests that has a huge impact on our mental health. Go further, get a dumb phone if you feel you want to go further. Second, if you're in a social media platform where you know that this is a conversation dominated by the nutters, by the tiny minority, you go and leave. Now, until now, the price of leaving was too high, but now you can go and get your information. Our attention is spent more now on longer and longer experiences of conversation on podcasting, newsletters, platforms like Substack. You have choices to go elsewhere to find the communities that share your interest. But finally, we have to understand that we cannot have control of our future unless we find a way to change the balance of power in this form of capitalism we have right now, where Silicon Valley dominates. And we see it right now with Silicon Valley getting behind Donald Trump. All the goodwill in the world will not solve the issue, which is we have to fight that power.
Who knew that RTE's Mark Little, the bastion of sensibleness on prime time and as an American correspondent all those years, would be in here with a fist raised in the air saying it's time to fight the power. But listen, the most important thing I heard in what you were saying there towards the end was we have choices in how we interact with
the kids are all right because they've shown us what those choices look like.
Yeah, okay, brilliant. Mark Little, thank you.